Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes you happy and why? It makes evolutionary sense that humans seek out physical comfort and security. It's healthy to be clean and dry and well-fed and well-rested. But why do we also line up at the box office to watch sad movies or line up at the amusement park to go on terrifying rides? And if a painting is objectively beautiful, why does it matter to us whether the artist was Pablo Picasso or one of his countless anonymous imitators? Paul Bloom is professor of psychology at Yale University. He explores the surprising research about what delights and revolts us in his new book, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Paul, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
What is pleasure?
I distinguish pleasure from happiness. Happiness is a fascinating topic. It's a long-term state that's affected by your genes and your religion and your income. I see pleasure as more short-term. I kind of almost jokingly define it as something positive you experience in 30 seconds or less. So the pleasure of eating a meal or of sexual pleasure or enjoying a painting or listening to a story, that's what I view as pleasure.
So there's a relationship between pleasure and happiness, but one doesn't guarantee the other.
Absolutely. It's hard to imagine a happy life that had no pleasure in it. But I think you could have a lot of pleasure, but in the end be robbed of long-term happiness. I think the two things are worth keeping separate.
So, Paul, how do the boundaries of human pleasure extend beyond where they seem to start and end for animals?
Well, that's the puzzle I sort of take up in my book. I'm an evolutionary psychologist. I think the pleasures that humans have, like those of other animals, have evolved through natural selection. And there are deep similarities between human pleasures and the pleasures of dogs and rats and other creatures. But human pleasure is to some extent special, and I think the specialness comes from many things, but one is that we're essentialists. So unlike other creatures, we get pleasure from not just how things appear to us, not how they look, but what we see as their deeper essences.
Yeah, you start the book with this now famous story about how the Nazi Hermann Goering was tricked into buying a work by Vermeer that turned out to be a fake. Nobody's sorry to hear he got duped, but we can sort of relate to how he must have felt realizing these possessions weren't actually authentic.
That's right. So when I want to make the case that we respond to the essences of things, artwork is my favorite example because it matters hugely to people who painted something. It mattered hugely to Goering that his prized artwork was not actually done by Vermeer, but by an anonymous, you know, a lowly forger. And you might think it shouldn't matter. We should just appreciate pictures, paintings, everything, based on how they look. But that's not how the mind works. When you look at a painting, you bring in everything you know, including your knowledge of who painted it and the circumstance under which it was painted, and this makes a difference to you. It makes a visceral, pleasurable difference.
Yeah, it's the story behind it that also matters. You also talk about the tale of Marla Olmsted, who at the time was a four-year-old. She was supposed to be a phenom, and people just went to her abstract works, and then it turned out maybe her dad was making them.
Exactly, and this is there's a wonderful DVD, I think, called My Kid Could Paint That,
yeah.
Describing it. And at the end, the DVD has a town meeting, which came after she was exposed or after it was claimed that her father helped her. And the dealer of her work stood up and he said, "Why should any of this make a difference? If you liked it when you thought it was by her, why does it make a difference if it turns out that her father coached her? Who cares?" And the man who did the documentary stood up and very sensibly said, "Look, when you like art, you like the story. And the knowledge that her father helped her changed the story."
And this fascination with the essence of things, interestingly, starts really early in life. Very little children start to label things according to what they believe they are on the inside as opposed to what they appear to be.
That's right. And that's what got me into this topic. I'm a developmental psychologist, and I study children. And I've been exploring the idea that when they name something and understand it, they do it based not merely on what it looks like, but on its deeper essence, on what they believe it to be. So even for the youngest of kids, a tiger isn't just something that has a certain appearance or shape. A tiger is something that has a certain deeper essence. So something might look like a lion, but really be a tiger. And the claim I've been exploring is that this not only affects cold-blooded aspects of the mind, like how we name things and how we categorize them, but also more visceral pleasures, like the pleasure we get out of something. And so some of my research on essentialism and pleasure has been done with young children. In one experiment, for instance, my colleagues and I find that children develop attachments to objects like teddy bears and security blankets, and we find that their attachment to that particular object, they will not accept a duplicate.
Yeah, there's a story in the book even of a little girl whose fish dies, and she will not have a new fish.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so this shows up in young children, but of course it manifests itself in adults as well. I bet you have at least one object in your life that is special to you, and it's special because it was a gift or it has some sort of sentimental or historical value. And if somebody was to steal it, it couldn't be replaced.
Sure. And I guess the idea, once again, the question is whether those things, we give them meaning because we need them to have meaning, or are we unable to sort of enjoy something unless it has this meaning?
It's a good question. I don't think there's any such thing as a pleasure that's devoid of interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Even the pleasures that seem the simplest, like the taste of food or sexual orgasm or anything like that, it depends on what you think the pleasure is based on, what you think you're responding to. I think this is involuntary. I think it's entirely all-encompassing. And this isn't to deny that we also take pleasure in the way things taste and the way things look. It'd be crazy to say that we you know, our taste buds don't exist for a reason. But I think all of these pleasures are affected, at least, by our belief systems.
Why do we have guilty pleasures?
Well, that's another way in which human pleasures are different from animal pleasures, in that we're moral creatures as well. And so we put moral value on our pleasures. And just as there's a distinction between leading a pleasurable life and leading a happy life, there's also a distinction with both of those and leading a good life.
Mm-hmm.
So some of our pleasures we don't feel are the right sort of pleasures. We feel ashamed of them. This shows up in all sorts of places. One of the interesting cases I've been caught up in is the case of the pleasure we get from pain, which has always been a puzzle and often is morally problematic, as in sadomasochism and other things, and we struggle with that.
And there's nothing like that in the animal kingdom.
As far as we know, there isn't. Paul Rozin is the world's expert on this benign masochism, he calls it, and he points out that humans are the only creature that likes spicy food. Humans are the only creature that likes Tabasco sauce. Other animals, like dogs, will eat spicy food, but they won't eat it if there's a non-spicy alternative. We like our pleasures with a little bit of nasty in them.
Does that also account for the fact that we like scary movies and violent movies and sad movies?
I think it does. I think that there's two stories to be told about the movies and imagination we like. And one is we like it because it corresponds to experiences we would enjoy in the real world. It's a form of reality light. People like pornography because they would really like witnessing certain sex acts if they were real. But there's something special about fiction, which is we can use the safety of fiction to explore unpleasant opportunities, to play with pain, to play with suffering. And I think this is what goes on in horror movies, what goes on in tragedies. We get delight from viewing at a distance, at a safe distance, where we know nobody really gets hurt, the pain and suffering of others.
Yeah, you write about the fact that something as simple as slapstick comedy, when somebody slips and falls on the sidewalk, we can laugh at that in a TV show or a movie, but if you see somebody walking down an icy street and they fall down, you inevitably, even if you don't go over there, you sort of wince and feel for the person.
That's right. It's another example of the essentialist basis of pleasure, where you're watching somebody and they're walking on ice and they slip and they fall on their butt. And the question is, how do you respond? And the answer to that is going to rest on, what do you think you're looking at? If you think you're looking at somebody honest to God stumbling, you're probably unlikely to find that funny. You might feel empathy, you might feel shock, you might turn your head. But if you think you're seeing a movie or a play, your response will be entirely different. It licenses humor. It licenses, you say, oh, that's clever, or that's boring. There's all sorts of ways you see things in a totally different light.
Yeah, it's interesting because particularly when they were younger, but to some degree now, my kids will need to know if they're watching a movie that the dog didn't really get run over by a truck, or they need confirmation that it was done by trickery and not real.
That's right. And part of what we know as adults is we know that there's a language to movies. We know that there are rules. I tell the story of how I was watching the movie Free Willy 2 with my son Zachary, and
there's pleasure and pain right there.
Oh yes, his pleasure, my pain.
Yeah.
But all the characters, if I have this right, are on a boat, and there's a big storm, and Zachary starts to panic. He says, drown.
Hmm.
And I say, look, they're not going to drown. And he said, did you see the movie before? I said, no, this is a Disney film. You know, they're not going to drown. Don't worry. And then, of course, they didn't. But in fact, what's interesting is, even though he thought terrible things were happening, I asked him whether he wanted me to shut off the TV. And he said, no, I want to watch this. Hmm. He was drawn to it. I think you find this masochism, even in fairly young kids.
So we know that kids pretend and play and work through these emotions. Why do we stop playing as we get older, even though we really love stories about the same things we might have played as kids?
It's an interesting issue. From an evolutionary perspective, what play is a form of practice. Kids play fight because fighting is a useful skill to know as an adult, and play fighting is a way to have the benefits of practicing fighting without much of the real harm. And so one answer to why we play less as adults is that we're no longer practicing. We're in the real world. This is showtime. And we the time for practice is over. On the other hand, a different perspective on things is that certain sorts of play and pretense go away in adulthood, but certain don't. And I've often wondered whether adults might be more engaged in imagination than children, not less. Adults spend a huge amount of time watching TV and movies and reading and playing video games and everything. And I wonder if you just added it all up, would you find that adults are more pretense-based and more play-based than kids, just of a different sort?
So we're not actively participating, but we still engage in that.
Absolutely.
What does this say for things like Second Life and World of Warcraft and these worlds that we want to get into? What keeps us from staying there forever?
There's a psychologist I know, and she sent a research assistant to explore, suggested, why don't you explore the Second Life and tell me what you think of it? And the research assistant essentially never came back. She just got lost in it and refused to go to work and everything. And people in video games and in the Second Life, they often fall into this. To some extent, they may find it a better life than the one that they're having. And the only reason they don't spend all their time in it is that they have to make a living and eat and, you know, and make money.
Well, let's talk about that. Is there pleasure also in self-denial? Sometimes it seems like if you wait until after something to reward yourself, it's better.
I think so. And I think that pleasure falls into two types. One is just simply the contrast, where if I go a long time without drinking water, and I drink water, it tastes, you know, it's terrific.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of abstinence is a sort of a clever way of enhancing one's pleasure because when you really want something, it's the horrible cliche line of hunger being the best sauce. But a second characteristic is, to some extent, self-control is itself pleasurable. There's sort of a masochistic pleasure in being able to deny yourself what you want. I think a lot of it is the pleasure of control. Things are much more enjoyable when you're not at the whim of fate, but you have a say over it. And I think that there's a joy in denial. And this is part of the kick some people get from exercise, for instance, and dieting. It's strange to view these as pleasurable activities, but some people, at least for a little while, enjoy them.
Paul Bloom is my guest. He's professor of psychology at Yale. His new book is called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Paul Bloom. He's professor of psychology at Yale University. His new book is called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You know, it's interesting, Paul, when you talk about self-denial as a vehicle for really enhancing our pleasure in things, the inverse of that would seem like a pretty decent explanation for why we overdo it sometimes. If every day for a week a hamburger and fries tastes okay, then the next week we need to have a milkshake for that to be a really great meal.
There's some psychologists who believe that willpower is like a finite store you have inside you, like a bottle of liquid. And when you use it up, there's not much left. And so it's just a constant strain to deny oneself. And sooner or later, you run out. I mean, what's interesting is that sometimes these studies find that use of willpower in one domain makes it harder to resist temptation in another domain. There's some experiments, for instance, where they get people to do a psychology task that involves inhibiting a response. And then they see what they choose to eat afterwards. And if you spend a lot of time inhibiting a response, even in a laboratory, you're more likely to choose the ice cream sundae.
Wow, that's really interesting. So decide where the willpower really counts, I guess.
I think that's right. I think if you spend all your will, I think you could use up your willpower. You spend it all on one thing, you'll have nothing left for something else. So I think you need to choose wisely.
So we talked about the relationship between pleasure and pain. I want to talk about the relationship between pleasure and disgust, because kids are not born with this.
Disgust is one of my favorite topics, and you're right. Kids are not born with disgust. So every normal adult human finds certain things disgusting. Feces, blood, vomit, urine, rotten flesh, rotten meat. And young babies and young children don't seem to have that. Now, I don't think this means disgust is learned. I think disgust is actually biologically timed. It's in like puberty. Mm-hmm. It's something which isn't learned but doesn't show up in babies. And I think this is because for a baby is surrounded by body waste that they have no way of getting away from. So it would be a cruel curse for evolution to wire up babies to be disgusted because they'd be constantly self-loathing. But by the time they're about 4 or 5, they do become disgusted. They have much the same disgust reactions as an adult.
It's really interesting, too, because we take it as a sign of someone who is exceptionally disturbed if they don't, as an adult, display disgust over certain things.
Yes, disgust. Disgust is interesting in its connection to morality. It would be a strange person who showed no disgust reactions at all to the sort of visceral, the things that viscerally disgust normal people. People vary a lot in how sensitive they are to disgust. Women are more disgust-sensitive than men. Some professionals have learned not to be disgusted by certain things, like a surgeon, for instance, or many doctors have learned to somehow inhibit their disgust reaction. Then there's the flip side, though. I think often people are too disgusted. So disgust has a moral component to it that's very troubling. Throughout history, people have been disgusted by interracial marriage, by Jews, by blacks, by all sorts of outgroups. And I think many people are still disgusted by the homeless, by drug users, just a visceral reaction. And I think part of what it is to be a good person is to try to at least, if not extinguish it, at least try to disregard these disgust reactions.
Is there a possibility that those things are culturally based sort of sources of disgust, whereas others are more innate, the ones that have to do with physiological properties?
I think so. I think the proper story would be that we have an innate list of things that we're disgusted by. We're disgusted by basically rot, by rotten flesh, by waste. But this disgust reaction is very malleable, and so it could be extended to different social groups because humans are fleshy things. Mm-hmm. So it's not hard, for instance, to be disgusted by a group whose sexual preferences are different from yours. And throughout history, people, say many modern Americans, find homosexuals very disgusting, and they use this to motivate their view that they're an immoral group. And that is to some extent an extension of this innate system. But then to some extent, obviously, it's cultural. So the culture in some way points your disgust in different directions. This culture could point it at homosexuals, that culture towards Jews, that culture towards women. And so disgust is an interesting and somewhat troubling case study of how innate innate biases and culture can interact.
Yeah, and it does seem to be a matter of if everyone around you is disgusted by something, you feel like an outsider in the group if you don't feel the same way.
I think to some extent that's true. There's a form of social learning. Put aside disgust towards people, think about food. So, I would be disgusted to eat rat.
Mm-hmm.
But not everybody feels that way. In other cultures, rats A-okay. And I that's probably due to a learning mechanism of the sort you're talking about, which is that the developing child looks around, see what disgusts everybody else, and then learns to be disgusted at certain things and not others.
The other interesting example you have in the book, and I apologize because people are eating lunch during this conversation, but you talk about, let's just call them novelty products for joke purposes, plastic versions of things that normally come from the human body and we want to be done with them right away. You can know that's plastic and still not want it anywhere near your mouth.
That's right, and some people call this magical thinking or sympathetic magic or voodoo, but we often respond to things that... if you respond to X, then you'll respond kind of the same way to something that looks like X.
Mm-hmm.
And disgust products are the negative versions of this. People won't eat fudge that's baked in the shape of dog feces. They'll find it. They'll be reluctant to eat it. Even if they know perfectly well it's fudge, but it's hard to block that reaction. I mean, on the other hand, this sort of the fact that we often treat the pretend as if it was real could also be a source of pleasure. So that's how movies and TV programs work. I have on my desk a picture of my children, and I like looking at them. I know that's not really my children. They're just two-dimensional images. But when I look at them, it inspires the same positive thoughts I would get if my children were actually in front of me.
We have an email here from Jimmy in Richardson who writes, is there a way to force or trick ourselves into experience pleasure, like tricking myself to enjoy going to the gym or to operas?
That's the great question. I mean, I think for each of us, this is yet another way we differ from other animals in that we not only have pleasure and pain, we also have higher order beliefs about what we wish to have pleasure from and what we wish to have pain from. And I would certainly like to get great pleasure from working out and writing papers and less pleasure from eating fatty foods and drinking beer. Is there any way to do this? I think this is a sort of struggle that people have been doing for many thousands of years of all sorts of techniques. People, and there's, the standard laundry list of examples. There you could try to link up something with a positive thing. Every time you go to the gym, you reward yourself in some way. You could use imaginative acts to try to imbue your not-so-pleasurable activities with by framing them in such a way that they become more pleasurable. But, if I knew how to do that, I'd have quite a different life.
You'd be the richest man in America, and that would be pleasant. Paul Bloom is my guest. His book is called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, here's one I've wondered about for years. With the advent of the Internet and the dissemination of information, do you think that pop psychology will ever catch up to real psychology? And related to that, why are we teaching kids all this in school? It seems kind of important. It seems like we should, as a culture, commit to teaching kids how to deal with themselves and each other. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Paul?
Those are great questions. I think that maybe the boundaries between pop psychology and real psychology are collapsing. There's a lot of the best writers, the best popular writers on psychology. Like Dan Gilbert or Steve Pinker and many others are themselves, top-notch psychologists. And so I think the word is getting out about real, valuable scientific results from the field. I think to some extent psychology is a young science. I wouldn't rush to teach it in schools as I would physics and biology. But at the same time, I think there are some real insights from this field that that really would be good to convey to children and convey as part of education.
I want to talk for a minute about religion, because for so many people, this is a source of joy and transcendence and genuine pleasure. But in many belief systems, there is also mixed in with that an element of fear, of damnation, of sort of offending God. Is that accurate in the way you look at it?
It is. Religion is a hugely complicated topic. And when people talk about religion, they often mean many, many things. You're certainly right to say that it would be too simple to say, look, religion makes us happy. A lot of religion makes us miserable. I know a man who was raised as a fundamentalist and spent much of his childhood terrified he was going to burn in eternal hellfire. A lot of religion can really bring you down. On the other hand, I think religion has certain powers that connect with pleasure in interesting ways. Religion offers, all religions offer, some version of transcendence, some version of the feeling that that there's more to the world than what we encounter. There's more than the superficial and the profane. There's the sacred. The world, to put it the way I like to put it, there's an essence to things that's far deeper than what we experience. And religious ritual and religious practice could bring us in contact with this essence. Now, personally, the argument I make towards the end of the book is that science does this too. And actually, I much prefer science as a way, because science, for instance, could tell us true things about the universe. Actually tremendously interesting things. But I wouldn't doubt for a second that part of the huge temptation of religion, the fact is that most humans are religious, has to do with the fact that it offers us this feeling of transcendence.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Patrick in Richardson. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Chris. I just want to tell you, it takes great courage for the broadcaster to step up to the plate, for the interviewer as well as the author to take on happiness qualitatively and quantitatively. So I think it's just great that you guys are talking about this.
Thanks.
Thank you.
My question is, essentially, throughout some of these sacred texts, it talks about aspects of, you know, whether you want to call it, if you seek it, you will not find it. But this wanting to find great pleasure without understanding that there's another bottom part to the sine wave that is the bottom part of, if you go super high, you'll go super low. And happiness in general, relating to this word bliss, bliss meaning almost like an equanimity of going through life, like almost being non-attached to a way, but you still show love. How does that apply into happiness? And I just want to tell you, I love KERA.
Thanks for your call.
Those are deep questions. I mean, I find myself in agreement with what you're saying. All I'll suggest is that what you're talking about applies more to some religious traditions than others. It sounds, for instance, that you're talking about something connected to Buddhism very much, where there's a denial of self, a denial of earthly pleasures, a denial of these extremes, the extreme ends of the sine wave. And, you know, it speaks to the fact, which is an insight, which secular traditions have and religious traditions have, that there's more to life than pleasure. Although I'm fascinated by pleasure, and I wouldn't put it down for a moment, I would agree with the insight that many have, that the pursuit of pleasure is probably a lousy way to live your life. There are deeper values to be had.
And that's where the morality question comes in, I guess.
That's right. I would rather, like many people, I think I'd rather live a life with fewer pleasures that I believe would be a better life than one full of pleasure, but the pleasures were cruel ones.
I really enjoyed reading this section about our attraction to our mates, because we can all certainly appreciate movie star good looks, wish for them ourselves. But overall, you found that averageness seems to appeal to us more than astonishing beauty in our partners. What accounts for that?
Well, the case of what we find attractive in faces is a wonderful case study, because in part it speaks to low-level factors, like perceptual factors, sort of evolutionary psychologists study, like symmetry and averageness. But on the other hand, how attractive you find a face depends on who you think the face belongs to. It's more attractive if you think that it's somebody familiar to you. It's more attractive if you think it's from a good person or a bad person than a bad person. The case of averageness is interesting. There's been a lot of studies, even with babies, finding what sort of faces do we universally find attractive. And one of the surprising findings is that we like average faces. If you took 10 faces and then put them through a computer morphing system that came out with an average face, that average face would look pretty good, most likely better than any of the 10. And the question is why, and one answer is that the averaging process factors out anomalies. And many anomalies, not all, but many anomalies are bad.
So in other words, the supermodel is as much an aberration as the person who lives three blocks down that is exceptionally unattractive.
That's right. And that shows the limitations of the averageness hypothesis. I mean, average faces look really good, but the best faces aren't average faces. The best faces are deviations from average in interesting and striking ways. Most deviations are bad. If somebody says to me, you know, your face is substantially different from average, that's probably bad news. But there's some people, the most beautiful people in the world, as we judge them, do not have average faces. And I think that's part of the story of faces. But again, what I find really compelling is when it comes to your partner, your husband, your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, looks different to you than they look to other people. Your children look different to you. It's not that you say to yourself, I know how my child looks, but I love my child, so that adds extra value. Rather, it's that the love for your child affects how you see his or her face. Your love of your mate affects how you see his or her face.
Yeah, you're right about the fact that people who are married to someone who happens to be an identical twin don't tend to be especially attracted to their spouse's twin.
That's it. That to me, those are just incredible studies. So the question is, when you love somebody, or hate somebody for that matter, but let's talk about love. When you love somebody, what is it you love about them? And you can imagine giving a list of properties, their personality, their features, what they look like, how they act. But it turns out that basically when we fall in love with a person, not a list of features. And as a result, if you replace a person with a duplicate, which you do physically at least for an identical twin, the love doesn't carry on.
I suppose that's a good thing, or else we'd have a lot of twins staying far apart from their twins once they were married.
Yes, it is a good thing. Now sex often works in an opposite way.
Mm-hmm.
So romance and love favors the familiar. And while sex, you know, more so for men than for women, often favors the novel. So now imagine the identical twin example. I think that many people, many men, might find it thrilling to sleep with their wife's identical twin. Even though the body is, you know, pretty much the same, but it's a different person. So it triggers the sort of parts of our psyche that respond to sexual variety.
Paul Bloom is my guest. He's professor of psychology at Yale. His new book is called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. You can get on the line now to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your intellectual curiosity and design a curriculum tailored to your personal or professional interests. And you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Yale psychology professor Paul Bloom. His new book is called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk for a minute about how we attach value and pleasure to just inanimate objects. I walk into a Home Depot after the show, and by the top of the line tape measure, I might lay down $20. But if I want one that JFK once owned, I might have to pay $50,000.
We imbue objects with value, in part because they do certain things for us, so that's why we go to Home Depot and buy them, but also in part because of their histories. So the JFK example is a dramatic case where an object, the most mundane thing, gets tremendous value just by where it's been. And I think in general that explains a lot of the value that objects have towards us. We automatically compute their history, and that affects how much we like it. And so all sorts of things affect. The JFK example is dramatic, but all sorts of things affect the value that objects get. Things are worth more if you own them. Things are worth more if you choose them as opposed to having them handed to you. Things are worth more the more you paid for them, and so on.
And there's also the question of there was a series of experiments that took a sweater and said, this belonged to a movie star. How important is it to you? And it was discovered that if it was made a part of the experiment that the object had been sterilized, people didn't care anymore.
That's right. So this was work done with me and Gil Diesendreck and George Newman. And we get people to say, here's a sweater from George Clooney, for instance. And people pay more for it than for a normal sweater. And they'll even pay more for it if you tell them that they can't tell anybody that they own it, and they can't resell it. So it's not just snob value or some sort of popular appeal, but they don't like for it to be washed. The value drops substantially. And I think that's a very different, a related but different notion of essence, where they want something with, basically, to put it crudely, his essence on it, his material essence. And so there's always huge trafficking, and such-and-so was touched by this person, such-and-so was worn by that person. And we also find in our studies that physical contact matters a lot. It matters more, for instance, to have the sweater that was worn by George Clooney than the sweater that he just bought but never wore. A sweater matters more than a DVD that he owned, because you wear a sweater, not a DVD.
So, again, it's sort of magical thinking there.
It is. It is. It totally is. The magical thinking, in these cases, the thinking could be viewed as magical because there really isn't an essence that gets passed on. But I think it has its roots in, and this brings us back to disgust, it has its roots in a very reasonable evolutionary adaptation that worries about contagion and contact. So it makes sense to think about things, about where something has been, because that could really matter to you. But we take this rational adaptive system and we use it in a very interesting way when it comes to objects like George Clooney's sweater.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Harold in Dallas. Hi, Harold.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay. I'm an academic, and my partner died about 6 years ago, and I have hundreds of his books, and I need to downsize, get a smaller place, and I can't get rid of his books. You know, there's no chance that I'm going to read the complete works of Charles Dickens in my retirement, but I can't give those books away. And I guess I'm making a comment more than asking a question, but it just, what you've been saying resonates with me so today that I can hardly listen.
Because you feel like they're part of him.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a very moving example, and I think it just illustrates how objects that are you know, crude from a crude economic point of view, replaceable. You could sell it, get a new one, get a version for your Kindle or whatever, but they get value due to their history and they become really irreplaceable.
And why do you think there's a difference? There seems to be a great variation, though. There are people who are really sentimental about these sorts of things and other people who could, you know, walk into a furnished apartment and live pretty well without thinking about it.
It's a great question. I would give talks on this work, and often I ask, does everybody here have an object, something that has value due to its history, like the books that we just talked about? And almost every hand goes up, but not every hand. I have always encountered some people, and so far they've always been men, who say, I don't get anything. It's all, you know, if you want to throw out something and replace it with a perfectly good copy, who cares? But I don't know why, I don't know what explains the human variation in this. For what it's worth, the same people who say this, in my experience, have been atheists.
Really?
So, you know, it might be that there's people vary in every conceivable aspect. And it may be that there's a variation in this sort of essentialism that I'm interested in, and that some people have a lot of it, and so everything has sentimental value. They can't get rid of all the stuff they accumulate because of its history. While for others, the dial is set very low.
Mm-hmm. And I guess on the other extreme are people who hoard things that don't have necessarily sentimental value, but they can attach that to anything, a piece of trash.
I've always wondered about that. I'm not sure hoarding is the same psychological thing. I'm not sort of sure that the people who hoard objects do so because these objects have a special history as opposed to a more specific problem. But it might be. It might be. I know people who have milder versions of this who can point to any object that they own and tell you where it comes from. And because of this, they can't get rid of any object. And again, like you said, I know people on the other extreme where if their house burned down and they received a check that covered everything, they just shrug.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We're talking about how pleasure works, the new science of why we like what we like. Let's go next on the phones to Carrie in Richardson. Hey, Carrie.
Hi. I'm an identical twin, and so I found your conversation really very interesting. My sister actually is from New Haven, where your guest is from, and she's here visiting now, so we're together. And my husband has known us since we were about 11, and he's always been able to tell us apart, but we've joked. I've asked my husband, what would you do if I died? Would you remarry? He said, oh, I just see what your sister is up to. And it's a big joke because they're so similar that it would never worked. But that was very interesting. And then another thing that you said, my sister has a chronic autoimmune disease, and it's this whole idea of a connection across across lots of miles, and just the whole twin vibe is just very interesting. My children can tell us apart, but there have been moments if I have a flower in my hair that my sister wears, then they will look at me and say, oh, wait, you're not mommy. You must be, you know, auntie. And so it's just very interesting, and I just am curious to hear about your comments about that.
Thanks for your call.
Extremely interesting. One experiment I've been dying to do, and I think we might end up doing this, is to, we have a duplicating machine that duplicates objects. It's just a trick, of course. And we see how children respond to the originals versus duplicates. How would they respond if we were to duplicate their mothers, for instance? How would they treat this duplicate mother? And my bet is they would treat her as if she was a stranger. She looks just the same as her mother, but she's not. So she's a stranger.
So somehow they recognize that that's not the essence of mominess in this duplicate.
Exactly, exactly. And you see this actually in a clinical disorder called Capgras syndrome, where these unfortunate people who get this disorder believe that those who they love the most in the world have been replaced by identical duplicates. And one theory of the problem is they look at these people, they look at the people they love, but their emotional reaction has been somehow broken. So they see them as strangers, and as a result, the way they reconcile this is that they're not really my wife, they're not really my mother or my child. They're just somebody who looks exactly like them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Lee in Dallas. Hi, Lee.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I had an answer of what has been said to me about hoarding, and I've gone to the Amen Clinic. I know Daniel Amen's on PBS. I've been to a clinic in California and done brain scans, and we've also talked about hoarding. And for me, I don't know if it's for everyone, but the difference in hoarding and keeping sentimental objects is, as far as hoarding, it's like, for me, it's like being a bird and collecting things. And it's about not having enough. You feel like it is something like a post-traumatic stress syndrome kind of thing. It's a feeling, emotional feeling of I'm not going to have enough. It's a feeling of abandonment. And that's why they said that I have this hoarding. If I can remember exactly when it happened, my mom had to go to the hospital when I was young, and I was there by myself. I started pulling things out and trying to get them next. But that's the difference for me that they've explained regarding hoarding and sentimentality.
Yeah, does that make sense to you, Paul?
That's very interesting. I would wonder, and maybe this fits in what you just said, is that whether hoarding might be a bit of a different thing connected to obsessive-compulsive behavior more generally and not so much essentialism. Here's what I would imagine is a test to pull this apart. You take a hoarder. How would the hoarder respond to if you took away his or her stuff but replaced it? Hmm. Now, if the attachment is to the things themselves, that should be very unpleasant. On the other hand, if it's a general worry about not having enough, then that should be okay.
I think one of my favorite collector examples in the book is the story you tell about the novelist Jonathan Safran Foer, who has a very dear collection to him of blank sheets of paper. Tell us about those.
Oh, I love that story. It's if you think of things that have no intrinsic value, blank pieces of paper probably really count as something. But he collected this wonderful collection, and what this collection was the pieces of paper that great novelists were going to write on next. So he started, I think, with Isaac Bashevis Singer, and then he was like in the Freud Museum, and he got a piece of paper from Freud's desk that Freud would have written on next. And then tons of contemporary authors like Susan Sontag and John Updike and so on. And what is just a bunch, you know, he has them carefully labeled and marked off, but if you just look at it, it's just a bunch of blank paper. And if you think of it as blank paper, who cares? I have blank paper. But if you think of it, each one as a precious object with its own history, all of a sudden, that's a wonderful collection. I'd love to see it.
Do you think that our fascination with essentialism as we gain pleasure from things in our lives runs the risk of blinding us to things that ought to give us pleasure? There's the other example in the book about the world-class violinist in the subway playing a Stradivarius, and he makes like $32 over a whole day.
I think so. I think I think in two ways. One is our knowledge can enhance pleasure, but it could also blind us to pleasure. That if you believe, if you have a strong belief about the essence of something, you might miss out on some of its other qualities. In some way, experts on wine, for instance, in a certain regard, are very poorly suited to appreciate wine because they know too much. And their knowledge can infect their sensory experience. A different way in which our essentialism can be a bad thing is it could cause us to value things too much. The man who spent $50,000 on JFK's tape measure, is that really the best way for him to spend his money? Some of these pleasures, I think we might have too much of an obsession towards special and luxury objects, and this takes us away from the pleasure we should get from interacting with other people.
What about that? You mentioned earlier that adults spend a lot of our waking hours watching television, reading books. It would seem that many of us spend more time on those false interactions than actually talking to the people who are across the room from us.
I think for many of us, our social interactions are with imaginary people. And I think it's right to worry about that. I mean, the problem is these imaginary people are often extremely entertaining. They're entertaining. They have interesting jobs. They're extraordinarily good looking.
Better than your real friends.
Yes. There's a line from a psychologist I use, which she says that I'm very interested in why people spend older time watching the TV show Friends and not being with friends. Huh. And I think I think part of the answer is that we have cleverly developed imaginary entertainments that are more entertaining than the actual real people we're stuck with in our everyday lives.
So I know that you're always conducting experiments and different kinds of research. What do you have on the horizon right now on the subject of pleasure that really interests you?
Oh, gosh, I'm doing all sorts of things. I'll tell you one study I'm doing. This is with Lily Gio, who's a graduate student working with me. And she's showing movies to kids, to 4- and 5-year-olds, and seeing if they prefer to see a happy movie or a scary movie. At what point in development, for instance, would kids give up the chance to see something that makes them happy in order to see something that scares them or makes them sad? And we're entering that in a mode of curiosity. I don't really know how it's going to work out. I don't know whether this sort of masochistic pleasure is there from day one or whether it takes a lot of time to develop.
What's interesting about that, too, is there's that point at which kids don't know something's going to be scary, and then that point where they start asking before you turn it on if it's going to be scary.
Absolutely. And I think the right answer for the kid is a little bit scary. Mm-hmm. Not too much, but a little bit. That would be both attractive but not overwhelming.
Paul Bloom is professor of psychology at Yale University. His new book is called How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Paul, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you for having me on.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.